Hello and good evening, good afternoon, good morning, depending on where you are today on the planet. My name is David Orban, and I want to welcome you to this new episode of Searching for the Question Live. We have a really interesting and exciting guest that touches on a lot of topics that are exciting to me, and I hope to you as well. Robert Zubrin is an engineer and an author. He wrote I counted them on Amazon before we started, and I think we are at 14 books. The opportunity for inviting him came actually from the publishing of his latest, The Case for Nukes, that is going to be available in a couple of weeks after we go live. He wrote a lot of things about space colonization and Martian colonization in particular. And maybe we will touch on those subjects as well. But let me pull him in and welcome Robert to Searching for the Question Live.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your professional career. What made you so passionate about the topics that you then analyze and write about very eloquently?
Well, that's an interesting question. My first technical interest was in space travel and was incited by Sputnik. I was five when Sputnik flew. And I was already reading science fiction. And while Sputnik may have been terrifying to the adults, to me it was exhilarating because it meant that these stories about space travel were going to be true. And I wanted to be part of that. So my father got me a telescope. I did drawings of the moon. I made rocket fuel in the basement. I did the whole thing. And, in the 60s, we were going to the moon by 1970, Mars by 1980, Saturn by 1990, Alpha Centauri by the year 2000. This was the program, and I wanted to be part of it. I was all in. And so I learned all the science I could. The thing, only the first part of that program actually occurred. We did make it to the moon by 1970, but the Nixon administration canceled the Mars mission. By that time, I was in college, and it brought the whole thing to more or less a screeching halt. So, I got off the train, and as it were, and became a science teacher for a number of years. But at a certain point, I said, this isn't what I signed up for. And I went back to graduate school and became an engineer in a nuclear area because at that time, I thought the major breakthrough that would now occur. It was fusion power. And so I learned a lot about that and also fission engineering as well. And I did have the privilege of getting to know some people who were the original pioneers of nuclear energy. So while I was not obviously in that generation, I did get to meet some of the people that were. And there's some anecdotes in the book, The Case for Nukes, that come down that way. In fact, my graduate school advisor himself, his advisor was one of Fermi's team in the Chicago nuclear first critical reactor under the football stadium at the University of Chicago. In fact, he was the guy who decided to put it there. At that time, so nuclear engineering, I had a number of debates with people from like the Sierra Club, and they would say, we have to stop industrial progress because there's all this pollution and so forth, and we're going to run out of fuel, and time to stop is now. And I said, well, here's nuclear power. You'll never run out, and it doesn't create any smoke. And they said, we hate that. And why? And it baffled me until I figured out why, which was they hated nuclear power because it would solve a problem they needed to have. And now I went on from there and I got a career in aerospace. And that's where I mostly worked. I did work some in the nuclear industry and at Los Alamos, but mostly I worked in aerospace. And there's been some nuclear stuff there too, but also a lot of non-nuclear stuff. But, you know, then we come to the present age and now there's people saying, well, it's global warming. We have to stop industrial society because of global warming. And here we're going to stop this progress that has enormously lifted up a significant fraction of humanity out of poverty. But now we're going to have to leave the rest behind. And don't even think about trying to raise the whole world to an American standard of living, because, you know, you'd have to increase fuel consumption 5 times and we have to reduce the fuel. And so I said, no, this is just not true. Okay. There is a source of energy that can transcend fossil fuels in even more powerfully than fossil fuels themselves transcended the pre-fossil fuel energy sources, which largely based in biomass and to some extent wind. And that's nuclear power. And so I wrote the book and it publishes April 3rd.
Wonderful, wonderful. I have to say that by happenstance or curiosity or inclination, you picked fields of engineering that are hard, both in terms of the challenges they want to solve, space, aerospace, nuclear industry, but also you butted your head against important and complicated systems that are themselves almost like engineering problems. And I think we will have the opportunity of touching on how the objective of mitigating our transformation of the planet in a direction that is incompatible with humanity through embracing a new nuclear power generation is going to happen potentially not only through improvements in technology, but importantly, improvements in policy. That hindered or in many places completely blocked the opportunity of building and deploying nuclear energy in the past decades. And now let's talk about some of the frustratingly common misconceptions around nuclear energy, starting with probably the biggest fear that people who are not familiar with it have of being dangerous. Are nuclear reactors dangerous? And if they are, why are you proposing them? And if they aren't, why is everyone or almost everyone convinced that they are?
Okay. Well, a properly engineered nuclear power plant does not represent a danger to the public. And that is proven by the fact that we've had over 1,000 pressurized water reactors, which are the dominant form of nuclear energy. About 90% of all reactors worldwide are either pressurized water reactors, strictly speaking, or variations on the theme like the boiling water reactor or the CANDU reactor. We've had 1,000 of them, and not a single person, not one person in the world has ever been harmed by a radiological release from a pressurized water reactor. And the reason why and it is physically impossible for a pressurized water reactor to explode like an atomic bomb. And there's a reason why, okay? The pressurized water reactors and related types all use just slightly enriched uranium, uranium enriched to 3 to maybe 5% fissile uranium-235. The rest is uranium-238, which is not fissile. Natural uranium is less than 1% uranium-235. Now, neutrons, which are what drive the chain reaction in a nuclear reactor, their capacity to induce a fission, and this may surprise people, increases the slower the neutron is going. Okay, you slow them down, they have more chance of scoring a hit and causing a fission. And the reason why that is the case is because the popular vision, that picture that many people have of nuclear fission is that the neutron is like a projectile that slams into a nucleus and smashes it to pieces. It's not true. What really happens is the neutron is wandering along, and actually there's nuclear forces that can draw it into the nucleus, and the nucleus has a better chance of drawing it in if it is going slow than if it is going fast. And when it's added to the nucleus, the nucleus becomes unstable. It becomes too big and it breaks apart. It's kind of like an amoeba that has become too big, and so it breaks apart. Okay, and the reason why uranium is the largest element in terms of the size of its nucleus is nucleuses that are bigger than uranium tend to be unstable. So you add a neutron to it, it wants to break apart. Okay, and it does. And so you got to slow the neutrons down. Now, it's true that you can sustain a chain reaction if you've got very heavily enriched uranium. If you've got like 90% enriched uranium-235, you can sustain a chain reaction even with fast neutrons. And that's how you make bombs. But if you have uranium that is only enriched 5% or so, it cannot sustain a chain reaction with fast neutrons. You got to slow them down. Now, Rickover, Captain Rickover, eventually Admiral Rickover, when he decided to create the nuclear reactor for the submarine Nautilus, which was the first nuclear submarine, he said, okay, so here's the plan. We're going to both cool the reactor and moderate the neutrons, that is, slow them down, using water. Okay, so water is a great coolant, everybody knows that. But furthermore, it's also a great moderator, because when neutrons hit hydrogens, they lose half their energy. In a collision between particles, okay, if you collide with something that is the same mass as yourself, you split the kinetic energy that you have. On the other hand, if you collide with something that's much heavier than you, you bounce off and don't lose much energy. That's why you can bounce a ball against a wall, and most of the energy that the ball has going in, it has coming back. But if you throw a ball at another ball, they both scoot away, each with half the energy. Okay, so hydrogen's the best moderator. Water's 2 out of 3 of the atoms are hydrogen. It's a great moderator. Okay. And you can use it as a coolant too. But here's the thing. If water gets too hot, it boils. And guess what? Then you got holes in your moderator. And the water loses its moderating capacity. When there are too many holes, if the water is boiling too furiously, it ceases to effectively moderate. So if you're cooling the reactor with water, and now you get a power excursion and the water boils more than it should, it will shut down the chain reaction. Now, once the chain reaction stops, power is less and the water will stop boiling, in which case the chain reaction will start right back up again. And this all happens very fast, in microseconds. And so what you actually see is that the reaction goes to exactly the level of partial boiling where the water can just barely keep the chain reaction going. And so it's flat and there's just nothing you can do to make it run away. Now, if you drain the water out of the reactor, the reaction will shut down, period. It can't go. Now, what the anti-nukes said, okay, was, well, yes, the reaction will shut down, but there, if you run the reactor for any length of time, there'll be radioactive byproducts still in the fuel elements, and they're giving off heat. And so if you shut the reaction down, either by draining out the water or dropping in the control rods, which are filled with material that just absorb neutrons like crazy, just eat them up, they're dead, gone. Okay, the reaction power will drop essentially instantly from 100% to 7%, but not to zero. Well, gee, you still got heat in there. Okay, you got a 1,000-megawatt reactor. It's been dropped to 70 megawatts. That's still substantial. Okay, and if you don't cool that, it could melt the reactor. And what they claimed was that if this happened, not only would the fuel melt itself, it would melt its way through the steel pressure vessel that contains all the fuel, and that's 8 inches thick, break through that, hit the floor of the containment building, which is concrete 8 feet thick, melt its way through that, and then can keep on melting down into the earth, to the earth's core, and then scientifically continue to go upward through the other side of the earth and emerge in China, okay, which is a truly fantastical idea. But this was called the China syndrome, and there was even an anti-nuclear movie with that title made. It was actually a successful movie starring Jane Fonda in 1979. However, actually, in the same month as the China syndrome movie was released, a meltdown did occur at an American nuclear power plant. And there are conspiracy theories who say this was all a plot, the movie, the meltdown. I think it's just a remarkable coincidence. But in any case, it did happen. And at Three Mile Island, the reactor tripped, that is, it shut down. But then the reactor operators very, very foolishly allowed the water to be removed from the core. There were automatic safety systems that kept the water in the core and were pumping it around, but they decided to turn them off and drain the water out, which was nuts, okay? But so the reactor melted down exactly as the environmentalists said it would, except that after the reactor melted down, it didn't melt its way through the pressure vessel. It melted away about 1 inch into the 8-inch thick steel, and then it stopped. Okay, so it didn't even make it a quarter of the way through the pressure vessel, let alone through the containment building, let alone through the earth going all the way to China. Okay, so the reactor was destroyed, but there was no substantial radiological release. About 12 curies of radioiodine was vented in the process, and that caused a radiation dose to the surrounding population about equal to that which they would have gotten if they had gone to Colorado to spend the weekend skiing, because our background radiation here is higher than in Pennsylvania. But that was it. So Three Mile Island is the only mega disaster in human history in which no one was hurt. Compare that to any number of mining disasters or the oil fields catching fire, oil tankers or oil rigs in the ocean, or even the toxic pollution from photovoltaic cell production, which is gigantic. It's in China. They release fluorine compounds into the environment. They've caused massive fish kills and harms to public health, or accidents with windmills. The nuclear power has never had it. This is over 1,000 nuclear pressurized water reactors on land and sea since 1954, and not a single person has been harmed by a radiological release from one. Now, there's Fukushima. Now, the city of Fukushima was destroyed, but not by its nuclear reactor. It was destroyed by an earthquake and tsunami that, with the drowning and the crashing of buildings and all this sort of thing, killed 28,000 people. Okay, and did wreck three of the nuclear power plants that were there. But guess what? There was no significant radiological release beyond the plant gate. Not a single person in Fukushima or its vicinity received a harmful radiation dose, let alone a lethal one. And this is an accident that destroyed an entire city. Now, Chernobyl was different. Okay. Chernobyl was not a pressurized water reactor. It was a Soviet dual-use reactor that was designed both to produce some power, but also the weapons materials. And so it did not have a containment building, which is, frankly, incredible. Any Western reactor has a containment building. And and it was not moderated by water. It was moderated by graphite, which doesn't boil. So if you overheat graphite, you're not going to lose the moderating effect of the graphite. And there are things you can do with a graphite reactor that could give it a very weak negative feedback against temperature rises. But in fact, the Chernobyl reactor was not designed that way. It was designed with a positive feedback against temperature increases, so that if you let the temperature go up, it would actually accelerate the chain reaction unless you did something fast, which they didn't do. And they did something crazy that caused a temperature excursion that ran away, and the chain reaction ran away. And you did have a runaway fission chain reaction at Chernobyl. Now, it wasn't a bomb. Okay, in like an atom bomb, because an atom bomb has to not just have a runaway chain reaction, it has to have one that runs away so fast that it can release most of the energy in the uranium before the bomb has a chance to break apart. And that takes really clever engineering to be able to pull that off. But they did have a runaway chain reaction, and what it did was caused basically an unsuccessful bomb design, a bomb that has a runaway chain reaction and causes itself to disassemble. So they released about as much energy in that explosion as a large chemical bond, and that bomb, and that was enough to break the reactor apart. So the reactor, okay, the explosion, as it were, at Chernobyl was not something that would damage anything even 100 yards away, but it was enough to break the reactor apart, and the reactor is made of red hot graphite, which then exposed to the atmosphere catches fire. So this reactor was not only unstable, it was literally flammable, okay? And it caught fire. And now you have a mechanism, namely a graphite fire, that's able to take all the nuclear waste in the reactor that has accumulated over years of operation and send it up as smoke into the atmosphere. Now, the only people that actually got a harmful radiological dose from that, and there were some, were like the firemen and other people on site who were trying to put the fire out, and they're right there, and there's this huge radioactive barn fire going on, and they're right next to it, several hundred people got lethal radiation doses, either in the immediate or short term. But the fallout, and there was fallout from it, came down, and by the time it came down, it was actually not particularly dangerous. And while there are regions that have been evacuated because the ground has radioactive waste in it, actually, if you want to know, those are now some of the prime wildlife reserves in Europe, because the animals didn't care about the regulations, and they were quite happy to have humans gone from their forests. And because hunters were a lot more dangerous to them than the fallout from Chernobyl. And so you now have a very rich wildlife in the forests near Chernobyl. But really, the reactor was incredibly badly designed and badly handled. And even the activities done by the Soviet authorities to try to counter the accident were absurd. And so the people that were killed at Chernobyl were not killed by nuclear power. They were killed by the Soviet Union. And now you have to understand, so you may have had 400 or so people killed at Chernobyl. We have, by estimates, just in Asia, several thousand people killed every day from pollution from coal-fired power plants. You'd literally have to have 10 Chernobyls a day in order to match the death toll from coal-fired power plants. And so, yeah, so it is a safe power source.
So what is the reason that if I go out and ask 100 people and ask them, in the Fukushima nuclear disaster, pick one of three, how many people died? Thousands, hundreds, or zero, probably 90 out of 100, but even maybe more as a percentage, will pick the highest numbers rather than a correct number, zero. What is the reason for that?
Well, it's propaganda. I don't know if most people would say thousands. Most people might take your second figure of hundreds. They might assume that somebody got radiation doses from the smashed up nuclear power plants at Fukushima. But in fact, no one did. Now, if you want to know, the anti-nukes actually added to the death toll at Fukushima, because the very anti-nuclear head of the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Gregory Jaczko, in response to Fukushima, ordered all U.S. Navy ships to be at least 50 miles away. And they had been steaming to the rescue of Japanese fishing boat sailors who were shipwrecked by the tidal wave, and they were told to leave the area. And so probably perhaps hundreds of Japanese sailors were killed by the actions dictated by the anti-nukes, who prevented our Navy from rescuing them, when in fact there was no danger whatsoever from the nuclear plants.
So basically what you are saying is that the engineering of nuclear plants is trustworthy, and the propaganda against nuclear plants is untrustworthy, even more dishonest, let alone it is harmful at least, but in many cases actually dishonest.
Yes, it's quite dishonest. And let's take a look at the nuclear waste issue, which is the other issue that is frequently raised. Okay. When the Sierra Club had been ambivalent on nuclear power during the 60s because they saw that it was cleaner than coal or oil. But in 1972, there was a major propaganda drive by Malthusians. They published a document called The Limits to Growth. It said, we are running out of everything and humans are using up everything and growth needs to be stopped. And this eventually proved convincing to the Sierra Club. So in 1974, they announced that they were against nuclear power because it would encourage excessive economic growth. And then further, that to try to stop nuclear power, one of the best tactics to adopt would be to stop the establishment of facilities for disposing of nuclear waste. So when the Carter administration took power, not only did it do a host of regulations that made it much more expensive to build nuclear power plants, it canceled the nuclear waste reprocessing facility that had been under construction, and it also banned the concept of disposing of nuclear waste by subseabed disposal, which is the easiest way to do it. But then it launched a program to create a land-based nuclear waste repository under a mountain in the desert in Nevada. And this would be a multi-decade project. And they put all sorts of requirements on this, including that it should present no danger to the public for the next 10,000 years, which therefore includes to the public that might exist after the next ice age wipes out our current civilization and the nomads roaming post-ice age North America who might not be able to read English would also not be endangered by this and so forth. And yet, even with all these requirements, it somehow managed to meet this requirements, which enormously inflated its cost. They still campaign against it. Okay. Now you have to ask this question. Why are people who say they're concerned about public health and danger from radioactive waste want to keep the radioactive waste in cooling ponds near nuclear power plants in major metropolitan areas rather than under a mountain in the desert in Nevada? I mean, it baffles the mind to imagine that anyone thinks it's safer in the suburbs of Chicago than under a mountain in the desert. Now, but yet that is what they have done. And this has been done with malice aforethought in order to complicate and increase the costs of the nuclear power industry. Now, you should know there's no technical issue here whatsoever. The Navy, which has a lot of nuclear reactors because most of its submarines are nuclear powered, and some of the surface ships as well. Okay, they're not having any. They store their nuclear waste in salt caverns in New Mexico. Half for years. Okay. They say, hey, just get out of the way. We don't want to keep this waste on Navy bases. We're going to put it in the salt caverns in New Mexico. Now go away. So there's no technical issue involved in storing of nuclear waste whatsoever. It has been made an issue by people who want to make the problem insolvable.
Some countries, notably France, have been able to make a multi-decade decision to invest in nuclear power generation, and today their electric grid is, if I'm not mistaken, something like 70-80% reliant on nuclear energy.
That's true, 75%.
What made them different than other countries? And is their policy being sustained for the future, or are they succumbing to the propaganda that you are describing?
What you had in France was quite interesting. You had De Gaulle, who wanted to make France a first-class country and nuclear energy was the power of the future. And you had a French labor movement, even the communist part of the French labor movement, which was substantial until practically the 1980s, which understood that cheap and plentiful energy meant jobs. And therefore that this was good for both business and labor and supported it. So you had a national consensus supporting economic growth through advanced technology, okay? And so France did this. Now, compare this to Germany, okay, where in Germany, there's one of the three leading parties in Germany is the Green Party, whose raison d'etre is its care for the environment. And Germans in general, beyond the Green Party, have this passionate, romantic love of the German forests and so forth. And this actually goes back quite a ways. It's 19th century German romanticism, and it fed into the pre-Nazi, proto-Nazi German youth movement to the early 20th century, and which did feed into Nazism, actually. But it's not a Nazi belief per se. It is part of, though, the cultural complex that generated Nazism. But guess what? Because they decided to shut down their nuclear power plants because it is offensively technical and therefore contradicts this back to nature concept, the carbon emissions of Germany per unit electricity produced are five times that of France. Five times. The great green Germans are climate criminals. They are producing enormous amounts of carbon emissions that they need not do. And none of the arguments about the cost of nuclear power plants is relevant here because they even shut down the 20 gigawatts or 22 gigawatts actually of nuclear power that they had already built. Now there's geopolitics involved in this too, and some of this is pretty dirty stuff, okay? Because first you had Schroeder, the Social Democrat, who's clearly allied to Putin, he's a member of the board of Gazprom, built the first Nord Stream pipeline. And then Merkel, from the Christian Democratic Party, which is supposed to be a center-right party, not interested in red flags and all this stuff. In 2015, after the Russians began their invasion of Ukraine, she arranged for, number one, a program to shut down Germany's nuclear power plants and replace it with Russian gas piped to Germany through the so-called Nord Stream pipeline, which is known in Poland and Ukraine as the Molotov-Ribbentrop pipeline, after the infamous Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, in which Nazi Germany and Communist Russia decided to split Eastern Europe between them.
And why would she do that?
Interesting question. Merkel herself, it is a fact that Merkel herself was a Stasi informer during the East Germany. Now, a lot of East Germans were. At least some people felt they had to do it to get by. But there is an invariant in German policy, or let me put it this way, one of two themes in German foreign policy, which is there's the Germany that looks west and there's the Germany that looks east. And and there has been repeated as one option in German foreign policy has been the idea of forming an agreement with Russia to split domination of Eastern Europe. And this was done by Prussia, and it was done by Nazi Germany. The partitions of Poland, repeated partitions of Poland, and it was done by Merkel. And it was quite clear, if you look at the recent period, that the current prime minister of Germany, Scholz, was extremely reluctant to do anything to help Ukraine resist the invasion. He dragged his feet constantly. But anyway, the Merkel decision, which was therefore backed not only by her own Christian Democratic Party, but also by the Social Democrats and the Greens, was basically a decision to take billions of dollars that Germans were paying for their electricity to German nuclear power plants and instead pay it to Russia for natural gas. And that money, that money, which was equal in size, like $60 billion a year, which is almost the same size as the entire Russian defense budget, that money paid for Putin's military buildup and it paid for Russia's development of hypersonic weapons and nuclear bombs, So these, green fairies are not nice little pixies, That they are in cahoots with some of the most reactionary anti-liberty forces in the world. And the it has to be condemned in the strongest terms.
We will go back to the evolution of nuclear power. We will mention, hopefully have the time to talk a little bit about fusion and then space applications. But before we do that, given the status of the nuclear industry in the world, at least in the West, what are the similarly smart and hopefully honest moves that those like you who support the peaceful applications of nuclear energy can deploy to counter the effects of this attack that has been happening against it, and how can these policy decisions be reversed, where whether Germany or Italy or other countries too reject as an absolute position nuclear power generation?
Well, the most important thing is public understanding that nuclear power is necessary to create a positive human future. Now, climate change is real, okay, although it is not the imminent emergency that it has been represented to be. And that's an important distinction, because if you think that no solution is useful unless we can stop carbon emissions in 3 years or 5 years or by the year 2030, okay, then your mind is shut to deal with this problem in an intelligent way, okay? We do have time to deal with this. And actually, another problem is that the people who are screaming about a climate emergency actually have identified the wrong problem with fossil fuels, which is not the temperature increase. The temperature increase has been quite modest. It's 1 degree C in the past 150 years. And whose primary effect actually has been to lengthen the growing season, which is a positive development. The problem with the carbon emissions is not the impact on temperature, it is the carbon emissions themselves and the change of atmospheric chemistry that follows from them. That is, the 1 degree temperature rise, it's like, I think you live in New York. If you move to New Jersey, you would encounter a bigger temperature increase than you're going to get from global warming in the next century. And there's a lot of people in New York who are not moving to New Jersey; they're moving to Florida. Okay, where the temperature increases much more than they would encounter through the next several centuries of global warming. The temperature increase is not the issue. The issue is the change in atmospheric chemistry, where as a result of carbon emissions, we've increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere from 280 parts per million in the pre-industrial period to 420 now. That's an increase of 50%. That is significant. 1 degree temperature rise is not significant. 50% increase in the CO2 in the atmosphere is significant. And here's the thing. If the world is to achieve a decent standard of living, the amount of energy we use is going to have to be increased at least fivefold, which means we're not looking at 420 parts per million, we're looking at 1,000 parts per million or more CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, that has a number of effects. Some of them are positive. Okay, the rate of plant growth on land has actually increased since 1985 due to the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere, and we've measured that. Okay, but in the ocean, it's different. Because in the ocean, the factor controlling plant growth is not the availability of CO2. It's the availability of trace elements like iron and sulfur and nitrates that are only available in certain places in the ocean, notably continental shelves, upwelling areas, river estuaries, places like this. It's 10% of the world ocean is responsible for generating all the life in the ocean, or 90% of the ocean. The rest, the mid-oceans, are biological deserts. And when the CO2 goes there, it is not taken up by photosynthesis. Can't be, okay, because the other elements needed for the phytoplankton aren't present. And so instead, you start carbonating the water, and that changes the chemistry. It could make it impossible for the shellfish to produce their shells. And here, I'm not just talking about making it tough for clams and oysters. I'm talking about the zooplankton, microscopic animals that have little shells that are the basis of the food chain in the ocean, and the phytoplankton too, diatoms. And so now you're endangering the fish. And this is serious stuff. So can't have it. Can't have it. Okay. Now, there are certain things you can do that could increase the power of the ocean to capture CO2 through fertilizing it, actually. The environmentalists oppose those. But even if you did that, it has a limited take-up capacity. We don't need to actually to reduce carbon emissions below what we do now, but we do need to avoid increasing it to double and quadruple what it is now. And that's what's coming. Do you know, there has never been a more unsuccessful program than the program to reduce carbon emissions. Since 1990, when this thing became a worldwide priority, the number of carbon emissions worldwide has doubled. exactly as it did between 1960 and 1990, and did between 1930 and 1960, and 1900 and 1930. Okay, and why? Why has it doubled every 30 years? Because so long as carbon is the basis of world energy, and energy is the basis of wealth, which it is, okay, and people don't want to be poor, they're going to do what it takes to make themselves not poor, which means they're going to use more carbon. And this program to try to prevent this by rigging up the price of carbon, okay, to make it unaffordable to people of limited means, is, first of all, it's unethical, and second of all, it's impractical, because they're not going to stand for it. They just won't do it. Not going to happen. So we have to make energy more plentiful and cheaper without carbon, and the only way to do that is nuclear energy.
On one of your accounts, and by the way, is Twitter the best for the people following this to get in touch or to check out
fine.
What you're up to?
I'm on Twitter. And yes, you have my Twitter handle right there. And now if people are in the United States, and the book is going to publish April 3rd, and people will be able to get it on Amazon and BarnesandNobles.com for about $20, and also a Kindle version for $9.95. But if you want a signed copy from me and you live in the United States, you could send $29. That includes the postage and all that. To Zubrin at AOL.com. That's my email. You could send it by PayPal. If you live abroad, $49, because I'm sorry, but the postage to Europe and even Canada is absurd. But anyway, if you want to save your money, you can just buy it from Amazon on April 3rd or afterwards, because that's the publication date.
And I am happy to spread your email wild and hopefully the proportion of spam against people ordering the book will fall on the right side. So on one of your accounts, I think on a Facebook page, either you have or your fans set up, there's a photo of you with Elon Musk, which would indicate that you know, you hang out and you exchange ideas, and then, you know, whatever. Now, the reason I'm pointing that out is because Elon Musk believes that, and he reinforced that in the latest Investor Day unveiling what he calls the Master Plan version 3 of Tesla, that over the course of a given number of years, Tesla, as well as other companies, supposedly are going to be able to build solar photovoltaic plants and batteries that are going to be able to move the human civilization to sustainable energy. So, as far as you know, if he were to read your book, or as you chatted about these topics, if you had, what would he think of nuclear energy? Does he allow that it should be part of the solution, or he doesn't address that?
Okay, so I don't hang out with Musk, but I certainly know him, and I have. I was one of the people that helped convince him to make space part of his life's calling. But I communicate with him intermittently. Musk is, in general terms, pro-nuclear. He personally is not involved in it. He is involved in solar energy, and of course, electric cars and SpaceX. Now, it's interesting that his two most important ventures are SpaceX and the electric cars, both of which are improbable fields in which to achieve success. The motto in aerospace is, if you want to start, make a small fortune in aerospace, start with a large one. Yeah. And electric cars have been a commercial failure since Edison. But he made them both into business successes. Now, an area that he's been involved with but not achieved anything of note has been solar energy. I think Musk is right about a lot of things. I think he's wrong about some things.
Certainly when we colonize Mars, we will not be able to rely on solar energy, right?
Of course.
Because Mars is orbit is far enough from the sun that amount of energy.
Solar energy is only 40% as strong on Mars as it is on Earth. It's not to say that it's unusable. In fact, Spirit and Opportunity, the two medium-sized Mars rovers of the that arrived on Mars in 2004, were both solar powered. But we then did, for the more powerful rovers, go to nuclear power for Curiosity and Perseverance. Solar energy on Mars is unreliable, not only because of the usual day-night variations that, of course, always afflict solar energy, but because of the large dust storms, which can black out the sun as a substantial energy source for months. So the energy storage problems associated with solar energy, which are bad on Earth, are completely intractable on Mars.
Do we know if there are fissile materials in the Martian crust that we can extract?
Yes, there are. We certainly have detected both uranium and thorium on Mars. And we've also detected deuterium. In fact, deuterium is five times as common on Mars as it is on Earth. Deuterium is the fuel for fusion reactors. It's also used to make heavy water, which is the moderator in the CANDU reactors, which are fission reactors that can actually use natural uranium as their fuel, because deuterium heavy water is the best possible moderator for nuclear reactors. The Martians are going to have a tremendous incentive to develop more advanced types of nuclear reactors. I do not agree, and I discuss this in this book, with the people who say nuclear power would be great if we had more advanced nuclear reactors. The sticking with the Rickover pressurized water reactors is just too reactionary, and we have to do better. But if we did better, then I would be for it. No, I that's a cop-out. The people who say, I love nuclear power as it is not. Okay. The Rickover reactors, which still predominate, work fine. But that's not to say that we can't do better. Breeder reactors could get upwards of 90% of the energy compound contained in uranium, as opposed to about 1%, which is what the pressurized water reactors get. Now, the reason why breeder reactors have not been a priority on Earth is, guess what? Due to the inflation of the costs of nuclear power plants by delays in construction and all these other things, the fuel cost is only 5% of the cost of the electricity. If nuclear power plants hadn't had their construction costs inflated literally tenfold by environmental obstruction, then fuel costs would be half the cost of the electricity, and people would say, how do we get the fuel costs down? But when it's 5%, they say, who cares? The regulatory issues of introducing a new type of nuclear power plant on Earth stand as, to somebody planning on building a nuclear power plant, says, I'd rather just stick with what at least people are familiar with than try to introduce something new, and then we'll have a whole bunch of new what-if scenarios thrown at us and so forth. And if the nuclear fuel is 5% of the cost instead of 1% of the cost, why should I care? Now on Mars, on the other hand, okay, first of all, you're not going to have people trying to inflate the costs of building the nuclear power plants. But beyond that, okay, to mine uranium, you know, involves going long distances and moving a lot of materials around and doing all kinds of stuff. And it's expensive. And while it's, and on Earth, we have a very well-developed transportation system, railroad ships, all this stuff. On Mars, those things don't exist. You're going to want to try to minimize the amount of mining you need to do to create a certain amount of energy. So I think the Martians are going to push breeder reactors. And in fact, I think the Martians will push thorium breeder reactors because thorium is four times as common as uranium, both on Earth and Mars. And once again, there's been no real driver for this on Earth, even though these possibilities have been known certainly since the 50s and even the 40s in some cases. And the and then fusion. Okay, once again, you know, fusion is cool. I was certainly interested in it, and there are some people interested in it. But there's no urgency behind it because on Earth, look, frankly, you can make tons of energy just by taking this stuff that you find in the ground called fossil fuels and reacting it with oxygen, which is free. On Mars, you can make fossil fuels, but it takes energy to do it. And you have to make the oxygen too. So on Mars, it's all about nuclear, and mining uranium and thorium is going to be harder to do on Mars than it is on Earth for the reasons I've discussed. But deuterium is present in every gallon of water, and Martian life support systems will electrolyze water on a very large scale. That's part of any life support system cycle, is you have to electrolyze water. And when you get the hydrogen out, that's when you can separate the heavy hydrogen from the light hydrogen. It's the dominant cost of producing heavy hydrogen. And it's going to be done on a large scale on Mars just due to the nature of the place. So Martians are going to have an enormous incentive to want to develop fusion reactors. And I think they will. You know, the British invented the steam engine, but it was Americans, early Americans, who invented the steam boat. Okay. The first steamboat, an unsuccessful one, was demonstrated for the Constitutional Assembly in 1787. And the first successful steamboat, the Clermont, in 1807, sailed up the Hudson River. Its sponsor was, its designer was Fulton, of course, and his financier was Robert Livingston, who was on the committee that wrote the Declaration of Independence and negotiated the Louisiana Purchase. And, of course, in early America, railroads didn't yet exist and real highways didn't exist. The only real highways we had were rivers, and sailboats don't really cut it on rivers. So if you wanted to have a good transportation system into the American interior, steamboats were the way to go. And it was Americans who worked out the problem. And in the course of doing that, we developed high pressure steam engines, which were much more efficient than the low pressure steam engine that Watt invented. And these led to engines that were efficient enough to power railroads. And between steamboats and railroads, you have 19th century technology revolutionizing the world, okay? And so it's the frontier that drove these innovations. And in the same way, the steam engines didn't really become efficient until they had to be put on ships and locomotives. I think nuclear reactors and fusion reactors will become truly efficient when they're needed, for Mars and for spaceships. Okay.
It's interesting because the frontier that invents and creates a lot of value, and then in the case of the United States, an economy that thrives on trade and commerce and exports.
And innovation.
And on Mars, you mentioned the need for nuclear and fusion, and in analogy, the possibility that it would be the Martian frontier to perfect and to deploy at scale these solutions in order to boot up and really leverage the ingenuity of the Martians for their own civilization. And I may want to add that, given the fact that the Martian civilization will need to be circular, in terms of using water, using air, using everything they can, and waste as little as they can, it could represent, I don't know if you agree or not, kind of a symbiosis where technological innovation and sustainability go hand in hand in order to then export back to Earth both technologies, the technologies of fusion energy and the technologies of circular economy, that here on Earth, because we can afford to waste, we can afford to neglect and ignore externalities, we just didn't take into consideration. And I wonder whether that both will become a major export for the Martian civilization, as well as a source of pride. So let's go back to space.
I agree with that, actually. Yes.
Thank you. Let's go back to space. You said that fusion is going to be important for space exploration. Do you expect fusion to be needed in the solar system as well, or mostly for interstellar missions?
Well, I think that once fusion is developed, it will have extraordinary value for the development of the outer solar system, and it's absolutely necessary for interstellar flight. Look, the civilization of the future, I mean, you talk about asteroid mining. You don't want to move all the material from an asteroid. Asteroids can contain significant amounts of platinum metal ores, okay? But they also can, that's as a minority constituent, of much larger amounts of things like iron and nickel. And that stuff, while be quite useful for doing things in the asteroid belt, is really not worth exporting to Earth. You're going to want to refine the platinum group metals out of the cheaper metals out in the asteroid belt. That requires energy there. Okay, requires probably fusion reactors. And then the propulsion systems that can give you the kind of speeds necessary to access the outer solar system. You really want fusion energy for that. We can go to Mars with chemical rockets. Okay, many of our Mars probes have made it to Mars in 6 months, okay, which is how long it took to sail from England to Australia in the 19th century. That's not an excessive amount of time for someone to spend in a spaceship. In fact, it's the standard rotation on the International Space Station. But spending, 5 years in a spaceship to go to Saturn, that's too much. To open up the outer solar system to human hands, we need much more advanced propulsion, and that will come from nuclear sources. First fission and then fusion is by far the best.
We are almost at the end of our conversation, which is fascinating, and I'm sure we could go for a lot more because there are so many angles that we could keep exploring. One thing that is, if I'm not mistaken, not mentioned in the book, but is on the minds of so many people today, is the role of AI. And there are at least a couple of examples of AI applications that already have to do with the topic of our conversation. One of them, actually both of them, come from DeepMind, a division of Google, that published an AI model for policy design, which supposedly could be generalized in order to better understand how certain policies are detrimental against the interests of the people that appointed or elected the policymakers that designed those policies, and as a consequence could lead to better ones. And the other application that DeepMind came up with that has been tested with a Swiss research facility is for the control of the fusion plasma that has magnetic container systems that are extremely complex and delicate, and you want them to work very, very well. So I don't know if you played around with ChatGPT, if you are looking at the increased acceleration with which the performance of these systems is approaching human level, or even exceeding human level in more and more areas. But I would be interested, both on Earth and in Mars or in space farther out, what role you see for AI together or without humans?
Okay. Well, look, the American frontier, in addition to innovating in the area of energy, also innovated terrifically in the area of labor-saving machinery. That was the other chief trademark of American gadgeteering. And that was because, of course, we had a labor shortage here in America relative to Europe or certainly Asia, which meant wages here were high, which means you had to multiply its productivity using technology. So this is what America did, at least in the North, where this was the model adopted. Now, Mars is going to have a terrific labor shortage. It's going to put early America completely to shame. It's going to be shortage in numbers of people and numbers and diversity of skills. So I think the Martians are going to be tremendous innovators in the areas of labor-saving machinery, automation, robotics, and yes, artificial intelligence, which is a way to add skills to a person, to diversify their skills. And also, yeah, sure, complex control systems might be usefully assisted by artificial intelligence. Certainly at Three Mile Island, if there had been an artificial intelligence watching everything that was going on, might have said to the stupid reactor operators, hey, wait a minute, guys, you're doing the wrong thing. You don't necessarily
let alone Chernobyl.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the Martians, and then people push further out, are definitely going to be pushing technology in this area. And they'll probably push it to an extent more than people on Earth are comfortable with. Because any technology of this kind is perceived as threatening jobs. And people need to see that, in fact, yes, it threatens some of the old types of jobs, but it enables people to do incredible new things. And this is what gains acceptance for going that way. So I think advanced energy and other things that multiply the power of labor. Energy multiplies the power of labor, but so does artificial intelligence and robotics. I think we're going to see them both as critical elements of opening the space frontier and of benefits that the space frontier brings back to Earth.
Robert, thank you very much. This was a wonderful conversation, very, very stimulating, and a lot more things to get to talk about, hopefully, in a future conversation we will have together, whether you will have published your 15th book or not. Yeah. I will welcome
you. Book number 15 is being written now.
Oh, there you go.
And it's called The New World on Mars, What Can We Create on the Red Planet? And it'll come out a year from now. And it's the premise of the book is we will soon be able to go to Mars in substantial numbers. So the real question is, what will we create there? And so the book takes a hard look at what kind of societies are likely to be successful on Mars in terms of not just technology and even economics, but the social systems, the cultural norms, the aesthetics, everything. And what does this mean for humanity as a whole? So that's the next book, but that'll be out a year from now. Right now, the new book is The Case for Nukes.
And I very much enjoyed reading it, as well as having a conversation with you about it. So I invite our viewers to go and grab it as soon as they can, including sending you an email to zubrin@aol.com for a signed copy.
Right. So yeah, you can get a signed copy from me now, but if you want to save money, just wait 2 weeks and get it from Amazon. Either way is fine with me. But I hope you do one or the other, because I think the book has a lot to offer.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert, again.
All right.
Thank you, everyone, for being here with us today on Searching for the Question Live. And I am looking forward to see you certainly a year from now with Robert for commenting the topics of his new book, but hopefully sooner in our next episode.